I'm Kimberly Arriola. It's a pleasure to be here today. I have no relationships to disclose. I'd like to just start with the learning objectives at the end of the session. It's my expectation that participants will be able to list the steps involved in obtaining a kidney transplant, describe the role that racism plays in access to renal transplant, identify three levels of racism, and describe how the three levels operate within each level of the socio-ecological framework to impact renal transplant. But before I get started, I'd like to get a sense of people's level of involvement with organ and tissue donation and transplantation. So please raise your hand if you know a family member of a deceased donor or a person who donated an organ while living. Oh, wow. Wow, okay. You all are a select group now. Raise your hand if you know a person who received an organ. Okay, if you know someone who is or was on dialysis. Wow, and no judgment here, but raise your hand if you are registered on your state donor registry. I love it. Much of what we know about organ and tissue donation transplantation is based on our own personal experiences. But be it good or bad, we also learn very much from the media. And so there have been very popular movies like John Q, 7 Pounds, and My Sister's Keeper that have confronted this issue of organ and tissue donation and transplantation from various perspectives. There have been countless other books, television shows, and news stories on this issue. Now, some argue that these representations in the media confirm stereotypes, whereas others argue that just raising the level of awareness is actually a good thing. Before I get started, I'd like to just make sense sure we're all on the same page on what I mean by organ transplantation. It is the process of surgically removing a donated organ from one person into a patient with end-stage organ failure. There are two major types, living donor transplant and deceased donor transplant. There are major advantages to transplantation, including preservation of life, the improved quality of life, and longer life. At the same time, there are very real disadvantages associated with transplantation because major surgery confers risk. Organ rejection is possible, patients have to take immunosuppressant drugs for the life of the organ, and one may need to wait an extended period of time for an organ to become available if it ever does. For much of this presentation, I'm going to focus on kidney transplant because it is the type of transplant that's most common. The greatest problem that my field faces is that the supply of organs is significantly lower than the need. Because of this large gap, there is added pressure on the system to be maximally efficient in the allocation of organs. So this slide demonstrates a widening gap between the number of patients who are registered on the patient on the donor on the registration list, and the number of donors recovered and transplants actually performed. And I'll just mention that 2015 data is a slight drop because we haven't finished the year yet, and so by the end of the year, I expect that to be to look a little different. So the system would ideally be set up in a way that maximizes the benefit that each recipient receives from the transplanted organ. Now that benefit could be operationalized as improved length of life or improved quality of life. But for those reasons, there is a pretty extensive process for getting a transplant. And there are these 8 major steps that have been identified in the research literature. And one of the main findings is that there are racial disparities at virtually every step in the process. It is well documented. It's been demonstrated by multiple studies over time using multiple samples in multiple areas of the country. So one example is the study by Rachel Patzer, a colleague of mine at Emory. And in this study, what you can see in panel A is that what panel A demonstrates, the proportion of eligible patients completing each transplant step among those who completed the previous step. And so what you can see is that there are racial disparities in terms of blacks having being less likely to start the evaluation process, to be waitlisted, and to be transplanted. But there is no significant difference in terms of actually completing the evaluation process. Panel B documents racial disparities in terms of median duration or days to complete the transplant step. And what you can see is that blacks, there's a longer period of time between blacks being referred for transplant, being going from referral to evaluation, and then the largest disparity is concerning actually blacks being able to get waitlisted. So this is one paper that uses national surveillance data to document these racial disparities. And so there's been several papers in the literature that explore why these racial disparities exist. This is just one example of a paper that explores both biological and non-biological reasons for these racial disparities. And you can see the biological disparities there, and there's some studies that support those reasons or those explanations. But this paper focuses more of its time on the non-biological factors, for which they break down into patient-related factors and system-related factors. And you can see what those are there. The system-related factors relate to referral delays, inadequate transplant workup, and physician beliefs. But what I would argue is that this way of framing the issue ignores the larger social and structural forces that bear down on the transplant system, providers and patients alike, and that's racism. Racism is increasingly being implicated as a fundamental cause of racial ethnic health disparities, yet the transplant community has remained largely silent on this possible role that racism plays in creating and perpetuating disparities in access to transplant. I would argue that social context matters. Social context is hugely important. I want to talk about the social ecological framework for a moment. So this is just a framework to ensure that we're comprehensive in our thinking of the various levels of influence on this particular behavior. So there are many models in the literature. This particular one was published by McElroy et al. But this type of model argues that there are multiple influences on specific health behaviors, including influences at the intrapersonal, interpersonal, community, I'm sorry, that's hard to see, organizational and public policy levels, and that there are actually intersections across the multiple levels that determine whether a person would engage in a particular behavior. So there could be interpersonal factors that interact with things at the community level to determine whether a person actually engages in a particular behavior. And so scholarship in the realm of social determinants is proliferating. I feel like the transplant literature is a little behind the ball in this area. But back to the current topic, well, why is race so important, right? So in addition to being black, I'm a woman, I am heterosexual, I'm Christian, you could say I'm old or young, depending on, I guess, what your age is. But so why is race such a salient issue to explore? Why is race so important? And critical race theory answers that question by exactly saying that we live in a race-conscious society. So that is an important aspect of one's sociodemographic characteristic that shapes health behaviors. The theory argues that racism is deeply entrenched within the structure of American society. Now, the Graham et al. Paper offers 8 core tenets for how to conduct research in this area, one of which is that data should be considered in social context. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. So many of us in the room are familiar with Dr. Kamara Jones' levels of racism. She talks about institutionalized, personally mediated, and internalized racism. What I wanted to do was to talk about those 3 levels of racism and how they impact access to transplant. More specifically, and to also argue, and just to pay careful attention to the fact that we are addressing all the levels of the social ecological framework in order to be maximally comprehensive. So institutionalized racism refers to legalized, sometimes normalized, customs and practices that result in differential access to goods and services and opportunities by race. And so when we talk about differential access to material conditions, one could think about how quality education and gainful employment in this country lay a path to health insurance coverage, private insurance. Having private insurance is one of the single most important predictors of whether a person would get a transplant. And so it's not by happenstance that African Americans have low access to transplant, because there's this path, there's like this current that contributes to it that we don't talk about, we don't think about. There are issues related to power, access to information, the extent to which a patient has information about different treatment options is a strong determinant of whether they will get access to transplant. So if a patient just knows dialysis as a viable treatment option and doesn't even understand about transplant as a possible option, then of course they're going to stay on dialysis. Many argue that, and this theory argues, that the overrepresentation of African Americans in poverty is a function of institutionalized racism. So racism and poverty being linked is, again, not by happenstance. They are linked because of these social structures that create this current. And so all these things kind of align really nicely, in a bad way, to create a situation where African Americans have less access to transplant. I'm going to present a study. I won't talk about historical policies related to the match algorithm, but I will say that just this past December, December 4th of 14, there was a new match algorithm that was created, and we're still trying. And it was created for the express purpose of reducing racial disparities. The verdict is still out. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to test whether that new match algorithm is living up to its full promise. But there's studies that suggest that support this. So just thinking about racial residential segregation, there's a paper that was published by more of my colleagues at Emory, Laura Plantiga and colleagues, conducted a study where they explored they explored standardized transplant ratios in relationship to dialysis facility neighborhood characteristics. And indeed, what they found, and this is just a map of Metro Atlanta, because that's where I live, what they found was that those dialysis facilities that were located in areas that had higher concentrations of blacks, higher concentrations of poverty, and higher concentrations of individuals with low levels of educational attainment had lower standardized transplant ratios. Okay? And they argue that their effects were relatively modest, but they still really point to some really interesting kind of ecological factors that might also be shaping these access to transplant. And so I argue that that is a really nice example of how institutionalized racism plays itself out in limiting access to transplant. The second level is personally mediated racism. This level of racism basically refers to prejudicial attitudes and discriminatory behavior towards people based on race. And there's been a lot of studies that explore the racial differences in access to the most advanced medical technologies over over the past 10 or 15 years. And Balsa and McGuire argue that the reasons for these disparities are a function of prejudicial views, clinical uncertainty, and stereotypes towards blacks. Now, these physician stereotypes towards African Americans may be a result of unconscious or conscious bias, and there's an increasing literature that explores exactly this issue of unconscious bias and as it relates to kidney access to transplant. So one study conducted by Mayakovsky explored perceived discrimination and time to kidney transplant. And I just want you to notice that the perceived discrimination variable is significantly associated with time to transplant. What's interesting about this slide, though, is that the top model demonstrates that race was significantly associated with access to transplant. That variable became non-significant when you accounted for discrimination. When you account for discrimination, income, and transplant knowledge. And then finally, internalized racism, acceptance of negative images about one's intrinsic self-worth, not feeling worthy of advanced medical treatment. There is a widely cited study conducted by Ayanian et al. Where people say, this is the study that demonstrates that black people don't want a transplant, see? So this study is constantly cited as saying black people are less likely to prefer transplant. They prefer dialysis. I would argue that this preference, I say in quotes, is a natural response to histories of medical abuse and experimentation. And in fact, what the study really found is that, yes, in terms of being very certain, African Americans were less likely than whites, but just to want a transplant, there was no difference for women. There was a difference for men. And the reality is that these authors have said repeatedly that these effect sizes were much smaller than the effect sizes related to referral to transplant and to actually getting waitlisted. So I just want to come back to this slide in terms of the reasons for racial disparities. It's important to acknowledge that, if I could return to these reasons, that taken together with the conceptual frameworks that I've just presented, it's clear that these reasons here are in fact an oversimplification of a complex problem. They rely on circular reasoning to some extent. So to say that there's reduced access to transplant because of referral delays, that's circular reasoning. That doesn't add new knowledge. They absolve scholars, practitioners, and policymakers from the responsibility to look outside the individual, and it perpetuates this idea of blaming the victim. It really represents a missed opportunity for we as public health practitioners to understand the social context in which this phenomenon exists. It would be best if we actually lived in a world that acknowledged the strong social, political, economic, and cultural forces that systematically erect barriers to renal transplant for African American patients. to African American patients, excuse me. So I just would like to close with just a couple of very quick recommendations related to clinical practice, research, and policy. So in thinking about clinical practice, we have to start by acknowledging that we live in a race-conscious society. One could think about the importance of training practitioners. There have actually been some successful interventions around training people to acknowledge and address unconscious bias. I will say you could also think about this from a carrot and a stick approach. You could think about clinical practice being implemented in a way that actually incentivizes clinicians to refer patients for a transplant or penalizes clinicians for having, you know, racial disparities. You could also do this at the dialysis facility level. So that carrot and stick approach is an important way to think about this as well. You could develop and test the effectiveness of patient navigation programs to enhance completion of evaluation. Patient navigation is a mechanism that's been used to improve access to cancer screening and care. And you could also develop and test culturally sensitive patient education interventions. At the policy level, it's been recommended that we establish core elements of patient education for chronic kidney disease treatment options. So this idea that a patient who just goes out and gets the best information about transplant, about treatment options, is not advantaged over the patient that wasn't able to get that information. Expand Medicare coverage for immunosuppressant medication beyond 3 years. So if patients can't document that they can support their immunosuppressants for more than 3 years, they're typically not eligible for a transplant. And finally, research recommendations. Again, you could develop and test, and I think the testing of patient navigation is really important. You could conduct mixed methods research. I think that mixed methods research is important to understand context. To just say that patients prefer a particular treatment option without understanding the context in which that preference exists, I think is an injustice. And then finally, you can conduct mixed methods research on African American patients who were successfully transplanted. So in conclusion, hearkening back to my earlier reference to images in the media, racial disparities in access to renal transplant represent the perfect storm. But from a more positive perspective, the Renal Transplant Center has potential to serve as a model for how to address racial disparities in access to transplant and access to the most advanced medical technologies. But the current efforts to address racial disparities in access are stymied by a lack of acknowledgement of the influence of racism. This charge to dismantle the effects of racism in access to transplant is undoubtedly daunting, but a clear acknowledgement of its role in creating racial and ethnic disparities in access to transplant is a critical place to start. Thank you.